sent out at the end of last week a sheet with an introduction to Maseches Ksuvos. And you should have that, but I will share it also so that people will be able to see. I'm just writing down the names of those I need to add to the email list. Okay, but I'm going to share the screen so that you'll see it in front of you. I want to run through just a little bit of an intro so that we're not walking in blind to the Masechta. So you can see it here on your page. Hopefully it's all showing up. The basic themes of the Masechta are what I put at the top of the page. It is, as I mentioned when we were choosing which Masechta to use, it is a Shas Masechta in the sense that it veers out of its core topic to go into various other things. But primarily, it's about property during and after the end of a marriage. Who has ownership and control of that property? What are the obligations? The obligations of spouses to each other financially and otherwise during the course of a marriage, as well as laws affecting non-marital sexual relationships. And that's something that, again, we'll get into within the Masechta, but something certainly to be aware of. Some words that come up quite a bit. It's good to make sure that we have a shared dictionary here, because there are terms that are technical terms that are going to come up over and over again. So first of all, two stages of marriage, and I know that for many people this is something that they already know well. Nonetheless, I think it's worth taking a moment to review. Marriage is created in a two-step process. In Judaism, the first step is Kiddushin, also known as Erusin, and then the second step is Nisuin. Today, in our weddings, Kiddushin is generally accomplished by giving a ring. The man gives the woman a ring. They also have a bracha that is recited, and then there's a cup of wine as well that they drink. After that, they are married. Nonetheless, they are prohibited to each other. Sexual relations are still prohibited until you complete Nisuin, which is the second stage. And the second stage is subject to some debate, this Nisuin stage, as to whether it takes place with the blessings under the chuppah. Does it happen via yichud? Does it happen when they stand together under the chuppah? That's subject to some debate. But the key is to know Kiddushin / Erusin and Nisuin. That's number one. Number two, a woman's age. So there are three stages of a woman's age in halacha. There is ketana, nara, and 29. No, just kidding. There's ketana, nara, and bogeres. A ketana is a girl who is not yet 12 years old. A nara is a girl who is 12 years old and has developed signs of physical maturity, which the Gemara specifies. If a girl reaches the age of 12 and has not yet developed those signs, then she's both ketana and nara for various halachic purposes. Once a girl is 12 and a half years old, she becomes a bogeret, and that's an adult. Are we clear on this? Following? I realize that it'll make more sense when we see the laws that relate to it. Nonetheless, I think it's good to know. Legal terms. Arayot or arayos are sexual relationships that the Torah forbids. Shnios are relationships that the rabbis forbid in order to protect the biblical arayos. They're basically, like the word shnia sounds, sheni, second layer prohibitions. So immediate family will be prohibited under arayos, and then another relationship outward under shnios. And we'll talk those through when we get to them in the Gemara. Ones is the term for rape. Pitu is the term for seduction. Unfortunately, both of those come up in this Masechta rather prominently. Finally, the part that all the things that we've said so far, I think, are probably familiar to most people. The terms that are coming up next may add more to people's knowledge base. First of all, the ksuva. So we are familiar with the ksuva, or ketubah, or however people pronounce it, as the document that memorializes a payment that the husband agrees he is going to pay his wife upon the dissolution of the marriage. So in the event that he dies, or in the event of divorce, he or his estate is going to have to pay this to the wife. If the wife predeceases the husband, the obligation is canceled. He's essentially inheriting the money himself. So the word ketuva, meaning written, refers to the document, but sometimes we use that term to refer to the financial payment instead, the payment itself. We're going to talk more about the origin of the ketuba in a little bit. However, the ketuba sum, this payment, this financial payment, let me pause sharing for a moment. The financial payment that we are talking about for the ksuba, how much money is that?
200
zuz, right? 200 zuz. How much is 200 zuz? How much is 200 zuz?
Not much.
Well, that depends. I don't know.
One year's sustenance.
Not necessarily, no. The my favorite way, Clive, you'll like this because it came from Ari Schachter. The one way to look at 200 zuz is to remember Pesach, the first night of Pesach, right? Chag Gadya. Two zuz gets you one small goat. So 200 zuz is 100 small goats. So your ksuba is 100 small goats. That's one way to look at it. It actually is very hard to define within halachic terms. But that's your core amount. However, there are other sums that are also mentioned in the ksuba. If you're listening when the ksuba is read aloud between kiddushin and nisuin at the chuppah, or if you looked and actually, you know, carefully read your own ksuba, you know, there are other sums of money that are mentioned there. One that I didn't actually put on the sheet is Tosefes ksuba, in which the husband agrees to pay an additional amount. I didn't put that in there. And then the other is the nidunya. What's a nidunya? If you looked at the sheet already, you can't answer. Nidunya is a dowry. I assume that no one answered because they'd already looked at the sheet. The nidunya is a dowry. It comes from the wife's family. What's the status of the nidunya in the relationship? So the nidunya becomes what's called nichsei tzon barzel. Okay, literally iron sheep. What in the world does it have to do with iron sheep? So what it means is that the value of the nidunya is set at the time of the marriage. So the ksuba stipulates that he is accepting that the nidunya is worth X. He then takes responsibility for that property, so that in the event of divorce or in the event of the husband's death, that value that was set at the time of the marriage is due back to her. In the event that it goes up in value during the marriage, he gets whatever appreciation takes place. In the event that it goes down in value during the marriage, then it's going to go back to her. The meaning he's going to have to make it up. Wow, Yaakov Aryeh sent me his name. I did not know that was you. Okay, welcome. Okay. But that's nichsei tzon barzel. Nichsei malog, on the other hand, is property that a woman brings into the marriage for which the husband does not take any responsibility, or property that she receives during the marriage. Unlike the dowry, this property is entirely hers, which means that at the end of the marriage, the property is hers as is. She's not guaranteed anything, but on the other hand, if it goes up in value, the husband has no rights to it. The husband just gets to use it during the course of the marriage. So to make sure that this is clear, because it's going to matter in the course of the Masechta, Nichsei Tzon Barzel is property which the husband is taking responsibility for, such that a certain amount has to be restored to her at the end of the marriage. If it's worth more, he gets it. If it's worth less, he has to make that up. Whereas Nichsei Malog is kind of an as-is thing. And whatever she is going to whatever it's going to be worth at the end of the marriage is going to be hers. Is that somewhat clear? Somewhat? It'll become more clear when we see this used in the Masechta, but I wanted to try to set that up. Yes, please.
Does the wife, at that time, women could own property in their own right?
Correct.
So the wife would own that property throughout the marriage?
So the wife would own that property throughout the marriage. Essentially, yes, it's just that the husband has the right to use it. I think the term for it is usufruct. That he gets to use the fruit of this property.
Right.
So someone sent me a message here in the chat asking, do the same rules apply if the wife passes away first? So in the event that the wife passes away first, then it's going to actually go to the husband. It becomes with the Nichsei Tzon Barzel, I believe it's going to go to the husband. With the Nichsei Malog, it might go to back to her family. I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to look it up and check. Okay. So, a little bit more background on the Ksuba. Going back to the times of the Chumash, you had a payment called Mohar. And Mohar was a payment from a man to a woman that was active really at the time that they got married. You're familiar with the term perhaps, kimohar habesulos. So mohar was a payment that the man made to the wife. Interestingly, in Islam, they actually still have that. It's called mohar. M-O-H-R is the way it's usually written when it's written in English, although I've seen M-A-H-R, I've seen it various other ways. But that was a payment that existed, that was a cultural thing. It wasn't a Jewish thing. It wasn't a function of halacha. It was simply that you married a woman, you gave her this payment, and that was a payment that existed way back then. So the question is, does that have any bearing on the Ksuba? So the Gemara in Ksuba Sandaf Yud, which we will get to, God willing, sometime in the next 5 years. No, I'm kidding. We're going to go faster with Ksuvos than with Avodah Zarah. You'll see the way it works out. But the Gemara on Daf Yud, I actually brought it for you in source number one, but I'm not going to take the time now to read it out. I think it's better to get through the introduction. But the Gemara has a debate there, which comes up various times in the Masechta, as to whether the Ksuba is a biblical obligation or a rabbinic obligation. Tell me something. For anyone who has been to a chuppah at a wedding and has paid any attention whatsoever when the Ksuba is read out loud, what is it within the Ksuba text itself that might make me think it's either biblical or rabbinic? There is a word that is used. These Toronto weddings, people are looking to each other during the chuppah. They're not exactly listening when someone's reading the ksuba. So there is a point within the ksuba in which you say you're going to give, the man is going to give the woman a certain amount of money for the ksuba, dechazi lichi mideoraisa, which is what you deserve biblically, which is appropriate for you biblically. Based on that, or that as one of several proofs, Rabbeinu Tam argued that the ksuba is actually a deoraisa, is actually a biblical obligation. However, others, including the Rush, explain it differently. We'll talk more about that when we get to the debate in the Gemara. And the general tendency is to, in fact, assume ksuba is derabanan. Despite that word in the ksuba obligation is fundamentally rabbinic. There's at least one part of it, which is definitely rabbinic, which was enacted by Shimon ben Shetach in the Gemara in source number 2, it's referenced, which is that when a man and a woman get married, there is a lien on the man's property for payment of the ksuba. That lien is a rabbinic enactment by Shimon ben Shetach in the Gemara. You'll see here it's Ksuvas Daf Pei Beis. So Daf Pei Beis we'll get to a little bit after we get to Daf Yud, but it will come up. It will come up eventually. So the way this works is that the husband owes money to his wife from the start of the marriage. However, the payment is only done at the end of the marriage, with divorce, or with his death. And to go back to the question from before, if the wife passes away first, there is no further ksuba obligation. Originally, the ksuba obligation was actually due at the time of the marriage. Like with the mohar practice. So in other words, you married a woman, you paid her the ksuba very in, you know, straight up in the beginning. It was over time that it evolved to shift to the end. And here, if you take a look at your sheet at source number 3, you get a very interesting case. Because not everybody here is on the email list, I'm going to share my screen with this. It's a responsum of the Rashba. And this is a lot of fun.
Yes. This mohar you're talking about, is that paid by the husband, or was it? It was paid by the husband to the bride or to the bride's family?
So it's really to the bride. It's hers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you take a look at your screen here, what I'm sharing, or for those who have the sheet, you can look at it yourself. Source number 3 from the Rashba. Here's the following story of a scam that somebody tried to pull off. She'ela, Reuven Shayachayev Elef Dinar Bishtar Chov Lagoy. There's a fellow named Reuven who owes 1,000 dinar to someone who's not Jewish. Velo Chasma Bo Ishto. However, his wife had not signed on to it. She had not approved it. It's just he borrowed 1,000 dinar from the non-Jew. So the non-Jew comes and says, I want to collect out of Reuven's assets. Hotzia ishto shel Reuven ksuva saber ka'os shel goyim shayamuktam lishtar chov. So the wife goes to the non-Jewish court and says, I have a ksuba here. And it says, my husband owes me the ksuba from the time of the wedding. That preceded the debt. Therefore, I have the right to claim payment of the ksuba before this document is ever paid up. The gavsa ksubasa kolan achasim shenim to Reuven Baala. She collected all of her husband's property for payment of the ksuba. You follow? Are we clear? I can't see everybody when I'm sharing the screen. Are we clear on the scam? She says, all of my husband's property is due for payment of the ksuba to me. I am claiming that now, and therefore he can't use that money in order to pay off his creditor.
But it's not due now.
Sorry?
It's not due and payable now.
It's
only payable.
Exactly. So watch what happens. V'achshav Hotzi Shimon Shtarchov al Reuven Hanizgar, Vinisraimen Ubidina Yisrael. Along comes another creditor of Reuven. Reuven's been borrowing money in a lot of places. He borrowed money from a Jew named Shimon, who's wise to what's going on. And he goes to a Jewish court and says, hey, wait a minute, she's disqualifying all of our documents. Reuven Tawain Shein Lo Klum. Reuven says, I don't have any money. Shekol Mechasav Gavsa Ishto Shigbala Gizba Berkosa. He says, what am I supposed to do? She already claimed all my property when she went to secular court with the ksuva. Vishimon Tawain Shaosa Haguvaina Shelo Kedin Nasis. Where Shimon responds and says, that was illegal. Lefishelo Nitna Ksuba Ligbos Mechayim. He says, the ksuba isn't collectible while he's still alive. Hadin Im Mi. So that's the question. Who's right?
However, Rabbi,
yes,
you said at the beginning they used to pay the ksuba in the up front at the beginning. So if they were doing that, then she was in the right to say, I should take the money right away.
If they were still doing that. If they were still doing that, that would be correct. The problem is that already in the days of the Gemara, the payment is happening at the end. In the event that, forget this whole litigation in the secular court, in the event that Reuven's wife would have come to him and said, I want payment of the ksuba now, he would look at her and say, why? I'm alive and we're still married. You can't...
When did that change?
So it's already different by the time of the Gemara. When before that, I don't know, but by the time of the Gemara, by the time of the Mishnah, they're not doing it that way. Sorry.
Isn't there a lien on the property?
Yes.
She has a prior existing lien on the property based on her ksuba. So
correct. what we described from Shimon ben Shetach earlier from the Gemara and Daf Pei Beis. However, what the lien says is he has a hold on, she has a hold on that property in the event that the marriage ends and there's nothing else that can be used to pay her. But in the interim, that property goes to the creditor. It just may end up being taken back.
Okay, it could be taken back based on the lien.
Correct. So look at what the Rashba says.
Rabbi, what strength or ability does the non-Jew or the secular court have? We're playing with two different Batevinim here.
Correct.
So how is that going to work? I mean, the non-Jewish based in is not going to recognize the dates on the Ksuba. They're just going to go basically from their perspective, not right. I mean, they're not going to look at the quiz.
They look at the Ksuba as a legally binding document. As far as they are concerned, this is just as legitimate as any other document, and they're going to collect, you know, for her and all that. The question is, what would the Rashba do for the non-Jew? But it doesn't come to that, because the non-Jew didn't come to the Rashba. Shimon came to the Rashba. Take a look at what happens here. And I can't see Chuck's face, but I know that he's thinking about this, because several years ago we did a program with B'nai B'rith, and one of the key questions was the status of the Ksuba in secular court and whether it could be collected or not. But that's a bigger topic than we're getting into right now. But if you take a look here and see in the second half of source number 3, the part that I'm highlighting, what he says, what the Rashba says. The Rashba, who, keep in mind, is writing in the beginning of the 14th century in Spain, he says, Tshuva, mistabra shehadin im Shimon. He says, Shimon is right. Shimon is the Jewish creditor who says, hey, wait a minute, don't take that money for the ksuba, that money's owed to me. Haba'emes Omar, sha'osa guvayna shalok edinna says, he's correct when he says that collection of the assets for the ksuba was inappropriate. Masha gavsa lo gavsa, what she collected was not collected legitimately. Kebal chov, shagava kodem, it should be zmano, masha gava lo gava, is just like a creditor who collects too early. You don't have the right to that. Vakolshka in ksuba, and certainly if it's a ksuba debt, deshema lo tavo lidei guvayna la'olam, it may never be collected. Im tamos hi b'chaye ba'ala, if she predeceases the husband, then the ksuba is never going to be collected. Umasha amrit mishem arab ba'ala iter dinedunya nidna ligbos mechayim ein daiti nota lakach. He says, you quoted, she I guess quoted as part of the discussion, that the nidunya, the dowry that we talked about, may be collected while the husband is still alive. He says, I don't think that's true. I'm not going into that right now. But he says, va'od, and further, mi sefer ksuba nilmot shekol nedunya betosefes biyachad ve'ein mechalkim bizman peronam. He says, we list the ksuba, the tosefes, the nedunya all together in the ksuba document. They're all collected at the same time. Vizet nira li barur, and he says, this appears clear to me. So the conclusion of the Rashba is you can't collect it early. It doesn't work that way, and it waits until the end. Now, in addition to the 200 zuz payment or 100 zuz and all that, which has to be discussed, there are other obligations of the husband that are recorded in the ksuba, although even if they're not written in the ksuba, they're still valid as obligations anyway. So the three biblical obligations of a husband, anyone know what they are?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
She'er ksus ve'ona. She'er ksusa ve'ona sa lo yigra. She'er ksus ve'ona, which we understand to mean the obligation to feed her, the obligation to clothe her, and the obligation to have relations with her. Those are the three duties of that are midyal raisa, that are biblical obligations. And then in addition to that, you have rabbinic obligations. So the obligation to pay for her medicine if she's ill, obligation to ransom her if she's taken captive, obligation to bury her, obligation to provide for her after his death, support for her unmarried daughters after he dies, the inheritance of her ksuba payment by her sons from this marriage, in the event that there are sons, they would inherit the ksuba payment. All of those are Tanai Beis Din. Those are rabbinic enactments that provide for her that are also in the ksuba. I gave you a link on... Yes.
What about housing?
So support after his death is a combination of food and shelter. During she's with him, but that's for after. We'll see, because that's a big discussion that we have to get to much later in the Masechta, where we talk about the question of how long she can demand support in terms of food, and it may be linked to how long she's living in the marital home. So we'll have to talk about that. I gave you a link on the source sheet for the Ketubah of Babata. This goes back to the 1st or 2nd century Common Era. And it's a document which was found, if I remember correctly, in a cache of Bar Kokhba documents. It's a Ketubah from that time, which includes all of the conditions of the Beis Din that are memorialized in the Gemara and that we know about to this day. That's available. You can look it up on Wikipedia. And we also have hundreds of ksuvos in the Cairo Geniza, dating back to the 6th century, which also include these conditions. Now, that doesn't mean that the text of the ksuba can never change. If you go to a Sephardi wedding, you will find that the ksuba still changes. The text of the ksuba still changes. When you go to the wedding and they sing the ksuba and they start singing Canadian dollars, that's always entertaining. Ashkenazim are kind of stodgy. We just keep the text the same. But Sephardim know what they're doing. Finally, there are some financial rights that the husband gains upon the marriage that are not recorded in the ksuba. So the husband has the right to her work product so long as she wants him to feed her. Now, there's a limit on that. If she works extra, more than would normally be expected, then he does not have the right to that. That's a bigger discussion, not for right now. He gains the usufruct, which we talked about, the proceeds of the Nichsei Tzon Barzel, so long as he is committed to ransom her if she's taken captive. And he would inherit. Well, let me not go there. Actually, it's going to cause more confusion than we need. You know also that a husband and wife are required to have the ksuba with them in order to be permitted to live together. They have to have the ksuba. Although I did give you on the source sheet a reference to an article by Rabbi Michael Broyd and Rabbi Yonah Reis where they talk about alternatives today where they won't necessarily need to have the actual ksuba because records are kept of the marriage in various ways and because the obligations will remain even if you don't have the ksuba document. But that's something also worth noting. Okay, so with all of that as introduction, I'd like us to get a little bit of a start on the Masechta. Unless there were other questions about the introduction first? No, we're good? Okay. Yes.
Very quick one. If God forbid somebody has a fire,
yeah,
the ksuba document is in a dresser drawer and it is, as we would say, do they have to replace it?
Right. So the answer is yes. There are two different types of replacement ksuba documents. One is ksuba de ishtakach batos, in the event that you find a mistake in a ksuba. So you can write up a new ksuba to correct it. I was once giving a shiur in somebody's home, and they had the ksuba up on the wall. And I happened to be admiring it after the shiur. And I noticed that the wife's name was written one way earlier in the ksuba and written differently later on in the ksuba. So we took care of that. But yes, it happens that you need to write up a correction document. But for the case that you just described, there's something called a ksuba de irkisa, which literally means a ksuba that was lost, and it's a replacement ksuba. You have to write up a special one. It's not just a regular ksuba, because it has to say in it, this is a replacement, to avoid the situation in which a woman comes to Beis Din twice to be able to claim her ksuba payment. So you have to make clear that it's a replacement document. But yes, that's what's done. It's not a hard thing to do. Okay. So I'm going to share the screen with you with the beginning of the Masechta. So you can see it there on the screen. The reason why the word is in green is because Bar Ilan is offering me that I could click on it and get taken to related links. But we're not going to do that right now. I don't actually know what it would take me to in any case. But the opening Mishnah of the Masechta talks about scheduling a wedding. So we're told, Bisula, and when we say Bisula here, we mean a woman getting married who is presumed to be virginal. That's what we're talking about. So, Bisula Niseis Leom HaRavi. She gets married on Wednesdays. Va'almana Leom HaChamishi. Whereas a widow, and it doesn't only mean a widow, but anyone who's not a Bisula, so she'll get married on Thursday. The Mishnah is not going to explain why the widow is getting married on Thursday. Instead, it's going to focus on why the Bisula is getting married on Wednesday. Why? Shepamayim b'Shabbos bate dinin yoshvin ba'ayaros. Because twice a week, Beis Din convenes in the towns, b'yom ha'sheni u'b'yom ha'chamishi, on Monday and Thursday, shem hayelo tanas b'sula mayamashkim le'Beis Din. And what you want is to make sure that in the event that the first night he doesn't discover the signs that she was in fact a b'sula, meaning there's no bleeding, They'll go to the Beis Din in the morning and make a claim. So therefore, you want to do this on Wednesday, so that Thursday morning, he'll go straight to the Beis Din. That's what the Mishnah says. Sorry. So the question is, why not get married on Sunday? The Gemara is going to talk about why not on Sunday. You can already figure it out in the sense that you've got to prepare a wedding meal, right? Pre-refrigeration. Good luck preparing your wedding meal on Thursday and Friday and having it be good for Sunday. But we'll talk more about that. You'll see that the Gemara is going to come back to why specifically they want to do the Wednesday. But Rashi here explains why we're so interested that he get to the Beis Din right away. He says, it's the Rashi that I'm pointing to with the arrow, specifically the fourth line, the fourth of the wide lines, where the arrow is pointing, Ulekach tiknu shetinase bervi. This is why they said that the marriage should be on Wednesday. Shim hayalo tanas besulim, so that if he has a claim that she wasn't actually a besula, yashkim lebeisdin ba'od kaso alav. He will go to Beisdin while he's still upset. He won't calm down. Vim yeshos benatayim, if there's a lag, yesh lachu shema yispayes. The concern is, he might calm down a little bit. He might be appeased. V'tiskarer daito v'yekaimena, and he'll end up staying married to her. Now you'll say, so let them stay married? No. V'shema hi zin satachta v'nesra alav. The fear is that maybe she was a besula, in fact, at the time of the kiddushin, but between the kiddushin and the nisuin, something happened, and therefore they're now prohibited to each other. That's our concern. So Rashi goes on to say, what you want to have happen, I'm going to pause the sharing, what you want to have happen is, he goes to Beis Din, word gets out, and witnesses will come forward to testify that in fact something happened between the Kiddushin and the Nisuin. That's the goal, because they're not allowed to remain together. That's the idea. Clear?
She's misunderstood that between the time of the Kiddushin and the Nisuin, is she evident of Sota?
She's not a Sota. If she's Mizana, it's Nush. She's an Eish Hashish.
Well, but if he's Hoshin her.
You mean Kinoi and Stira?
Yeah.
Right. So Rabbi Grossman asks, well, the laws of Sota apply if the man warns her between Kiddushin and Nisuin, don't be alone with so-and-so. And then she's alone, and all of that. Will the laws of Sota pertain? So I don't believe they do, but I'd have to look it up in order to really know the answer to that question. It's a good question. I think Sota does not apply to an arusa, only to a nesua. I'm going to... I'm sorry?
Even though she has a din of ishes ish.
Yeah, I think because she has to be mutter to her husband in order for it to work. I think she has to be permitted to her husband, and she's not while she's still in arusa. So I don't think you're able to do it. But I'm looking now. No, it's sota chav gimel amid beis arusa ein ashosa. Yeah. Okay. So no, she won't become a sota. But that's the issue here, and that's why we want to make sure that they'll be able to go to Beis Din right away in the morning. Tosos makes an interesting point here, and it reflects the reality of the Ksuba. Tosfos says that it's specifically marrying during the day on Wednesday, not Wednesday night. Why? He says we're concerned that there might be a fight. Not what Katana might be. He says you're guaranteed there's going to be a fight about the amounts of money being recorded in the Ksuba. Back when there was flexibility about the sums that you're putting in the Ksuba, people didn't just put a stock text. So the Nedunya is valued at this, and he's going to add that. So, you know, there are people on both sides who want to make sure they're getting the best deal possible. And the result could be, if you only schedule the wedding for Wednesday night, right? And let's say it's the summertime in Toronto, and nightfall isn't until, like, I don't know, 10 p.m., the result is they're not going to be able to consummate the marriage that night. So you'll have ruined the whole reason for the scheduling. So because of that, Tosfo says, when we say Besula Nises Liomar V, we mean she gets married during the day on Wednesday, not Wednesday night. Clear?
Why would Wednesday night start on Tuesday night? Because the day starts at nightfall.
Because that won't help you, because then you won't go to Beis Din the next morning.
So you'd have to be gone.
Yeah. So that's the concern. So they were getting married Wednesday during the day. Now,
is this the reason why they changed so that we'd have a half hour between Eris and Nesuin?
So, yes and no. Yes and no. Alan points to a point that I really wanted to make before, but I jumped the gun on it, which is that in their day, you had up to a year between the Kiddushin and the Nisuin. You weren't doing Kiddushin and Nisuin together under the chuppah the way we do it today. That's why you could have had Znus happen between Kiddushin and Nisuin. Today it's a little far-fetched to think that might happen. But back in the day, it could easily happen. So yes, one of the reasons for abbreviating that time period could have been to prevent problems. You avoid problems. Back then, what happened was, you arranged the marriage, you had Kiddushin, and then the guy had a year to get his act together. To get a house, to get a livelihood, and all the things he's going to need in order to be able to support her. You'll see that's going to come up explicitly in the Gemara. But that does raise a question. Today, you don't really have a chance of znus between Kiddushin and Nisuin, number one. And number two, our Batei Din aren't meeting in the towns on Monday and Thursday. You want to go to Beis Din, you make an appointment with the Beis Din. Yeah, it's not as though they're just sitting there in Bnei Torah and say, you know, with a big sign up saying, okay, anybody who wants to, just show up here. And in the morning, the chassan show, that's the whole thing is nonsense. And it's not just nonsense now. This has been the way for centuries. So the question is there any reason for a besula to marry on Wednesday anymore? So I brought it for you on the source sheet here from the Nachal HaShiva. The Nachal HaShiva is a very valuable sefer. It's the resource, the go-to, for all matters involving legal documents, marital and otherwise. But he has a discussion which I brought here. I'm going to have to summarize it because we don't have enough time to read it through. But he discusses the question of whether we should still have the Besula get married on Wednesday. And if you follow along here, he quotes the Kolbo, who says, we actually have the Besulos get married on Friday. Because we have no concern. The Kolbo is an early Ashkenazi work of Minhagim and Halacha. And he says, there is no time between Kiddushin and Nisuin. So writes the Kolbe, who I think is 14th century, maybe 15th. So we do the wedding on Friday. Why do they want the wedding on Friday?
Save money.
Yeah, you save money. It's good. It account for a Shabbos meal. So he says, we do it on Fridays. Then he tells you, Ashkenaz in Germany, the Nachla Shiva writes, the practice is still to do it on Wednesdays. Even though the original reason isn't there, nonetheless, a minhag is a minhag is a minhag. So we are going to keep right on doing what we always did, and that's the way it goes. And he says, the same thing is true about the Haftorah, the part that I'm bolding, that I'm highlighting here. He says there's no reason to do a Haftorah anymore either. Haftorah was instituted when you couldn't do Kriyas HaTorah. So there's no reason to do a Haftorah, yeah, but we still do the Haftorah anyway. And he says the same thing is true for a whole bunch of other minhagim, blowing shofar in Musaf, and while sitting and standing. He says, yeah, we just keep on doing things anyway. This is what Jews do. So he says, we continue to do it on Wednesday, and then he says, there's another reason for us to do it on Wednesday. He says, because we have very small communities here in Germany, and we're very scattered all around the land, and people want to get together in order to be there for the wedding, and it takes a long time to get home. So in order to enable people to get home for Shabbos, we do the wedding midweek. He says that's our practice, and then he goes on to say, but there are other communities where they actually do it indeed on Friday. So the sociology of it, of choosing a wedding day, is very interesting. You have the inherited practice from the Gemara, you have the desire to count it as your Shabbos meal. You have the desire for all your guests to be able to get home. And all of these competing forces determine in some communities that they're going to do it on Wednesday, and in some communities they're going to do it on Friday. The most famous example of the Friday wedding was by the Rama. Rabbi Moshe Isserles came to Krakow to be the chief rabbi as a very young rabbi, and he had a wedding on a Friday, and it was getting late, and there were those who alleged that he actually conducted the wedding on Shabbos inappropriately. And he wrote a whole responsum defending himself. And he succeeded, and he went on to be the Rama, and it's a good thing. But for a while, it looked like the Rama was going to get run out of Krakow for a late Friday wedding. Go figure. David asked about getting married on Tuesday in the chat. There's no
question.
Yeah, it would appear to have no value. Sorry?
That's a proper mitzvah. My mother always said it's a perfect day.
To get married on Tuesday. So it's
on Tuesday.
That's not a Baba Maisa. It's going to be in the Gemara. Just wait. We'll get to that in the Gemara, but not today. So I think we're going to pause here. I'm glad to see a few new faces also, and I will add you, God willing, to the email list. You'll get the sheets in advance and so on. And next week we're going to start with the Siyum on Maseches Avodah Zarah. Those who did not yet respond to request their can of wine can still respond tonight. I'm going to order it tomorrow. Only for those who live in the GTA. And then we'll continue on marching ahead in Ksuvos. Thank you very, very much. It is very good to be back.